Coming up.
Self-reliance. Robot. A robot nice. Holding a robot tablet. I am confident, capable, walking, talking, learning machine.
My approach to breath, I wouldn't even call it breath work, actually. I think definitions, words are very important. And breath work to me is like a CrossFit workout or something strenuous. I mean, when I think of flow, I think of like Michael Jordan scoring 65 points or something in a game. Like he can't miss. He's like, no one can touch him. He's jumping higher, running faster, even for Michael Jordan. So, and that is a state where, you know, all your nervous system is just perfectly suited for the task that you've given it. There's a lot of practice involved too. Feeling my way is that it has to do with like, have you guys ever heard of heart math? I'm pretty familiar with that. It's like the little sensor you clip on your ear and then you have the app that kind of, you kind of breathe with it, but it's a little mandala that there's some studies where they looked at heart rate variability. Where did that get optimized? And James Nestor also cites it's 5.5.
We want to invite you to the first annual Munch Bunch Wellness and Rejuvenation Retreat in the Dominican Republic, November 9th through the 12th, 2023. It will be an all-inclusive retreat meant to refuel you, give you a chance to rest, relax, and network with others in our Munch Bunch family. We will also be talking about ways to get out of your own way so you can live your dreams, build your business, and do what you need to do. So check it out. The link is in the description, and the dates are November 9th through the 12th.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Munch Bunch podcast. It's Kimmy Nishimoto and Megan Van Noy.
Hello.
And today we have someone really special, actually, kind of a different sort of episode, Dr. Sam Zink of Boise, Idaho. Say hi, Dr. Sam.
Hello. Call me Sam.
And Sam is awesome. He's very dear to my heart because he has helped some of the babies in my life. I always talk about the twinnies and baby Leo. He has released 4 of my nephews for their tongue ties. And then shout out to the amazing Melanie Henstrom, who was their lactation consultant in the Boise area. They're kind of a power duo. You see Melanie for the lactation and the body work, and then Dr. Zink for the releases. So Dr. Zink, we're going to let you introduce yourself in just a minute. But first, we are going to do our weekly Munchy Monday affirmator to set our intention for the week.
Cool. All right. So it's very, very serious. All right. So I'm going to shuffle. You're going to tell me when to stop. Okay. And we're going to pick it. Right. Ready, set, go.
Stop.
This is the one. All right. Ooh, I love this because of what we're talking about today. So self-reliance. A robot nice. Holding a robot tablet. I am confident, capable, walking, talking, learning machine. And I practice total self-reliance every chance I get. Even if it's something tough, I can probably do it. Even if it's something new to me, I can probably figure it out. Or maybe just Google it. Oh, and no one needs to know that my self-reliance relies on Google. So
Or ChatGPT nowadays, I guess.
Yes, I know. Yeah, these are pre-ChatGPT, so still going to be Google.
I have not dabbled yet.
I haven't either, but some of my friends have, and I'm like, wow, okay, here we go. Yeah. So awesome. Well, Dr. Sam, we're so excited to meet you, chat with you. This is my first time getting to meet you. So for those of us who don't know you yet, tell us a little bit about you and your background and what you do.
Well, I'm going to borrow from a good friend of mine. He says, I'm a full-time human being.
Same. I love it.
But in a more formal context, I guess, I'm a dentist. I have a DMD degree from University of Louisville. But walking that back, I actually have a non-traditional path into dentistry. I was pre-med for a year, but then I decided to get my degree in computer information systems. So I graduated from Boise State here in Idaho. And then I worked in that field for a while. And then I decided I want to get my MBA. And I thought I would be a chief technology officer someday. And then at the end of my MBA, I'm like, no, I want to be a doctor after all. And decided to go to dental school. So ended up with, you know, a lot of school under my belt. But I think that non-traditional path has helped me see the world of life and dentistry in a different way than maybe the person that goes biochem, you know, biology, and goes straight into dental school and graduates when they're I don't know, 26 or whatever it could be. I was a little older. I was 28 when I started dental school and 32 when I finished. And now I've been practicing for 13 years.
Awesome.
So I guess you know how old I am now.
If you want to do the quick math, do it. The rest of us are not going to do it. Yeah. Did you start in traditional dentistry?
Yes. Yep. I wanted to have my own practice, but then I ended up working for a lot of the corporate dental outfits. And so I did very traditional dentistry up until, well, if you want to get into that now, it's really through my own family, through my kiddos. I had my third son was tongue-tied and got released, and we saw how much it helped him. But then when all of a sudden, oh my gosh, the first two had all the signs and symptoms and we had no clue. And my first was born when I was 6 months away from graduating from dental school. And he had all the symptoms, all the baby symptoms, all the mother symptoms. We just had no clue. And then my second son, like a year later, he was having a lot of sleep and breathing issues. So I looked into that. So that was around 2015 to 2017 was really I was still working in traditional dentistry, corporate dentistry, but through my own family. And I started studying biostatic, which is TMJ, then tongue tie, then airway breathing. I took the orthotropic mini residency with Dr. Hang in California. So just like dove in to kind of help myself, help my family, help my kids. And then I just knew like airway, well, my science is airway dental medicine, a term I made up, but relating to the airway, to breathing, to tongue tie, to TMJ. So actually my practice that I was able to start in 2018, so almost 5 years ago, it's very much like a niche practice. Like I'm not a specialist, I'm a general dentist, but I don't have hygienist assistants running around. It's strictly limited, not strictly, but pretty much infant phrenectomy, a handful of children and adult phrenectomies, but mostly infant phrenectomy and then adult splint therapy. So I do an orthotic, custom orthotic for TMJ for pain and tension and things like that.
Both That's sides awesome. Of the spectrum.
Yeah, no, I get to see, I like to help the infants because it's like, I can't imagine a time earlier in life to intervene and help. Well, plus then I learned Gillespie approach craniosacrofacial therapy so I can tune into their body as well. And then I see the problems the adults come in with, and inevitably there's an undiagnosed, untreated tongue tie. There's TMJ issue, bad bite, postural issues, pain, dysfunction. So a lot of my adults, I am doing like splint therapy and breathing retraining and tongue tie release all in a combination in a synergistic way.
Mm-hmm. I love that. We had the Gillespie girls on.
Oh, nice. Holly, yeah, they're Kim. Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I learned a lot from them. Class and the infant class in 2022.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. We learned so much during their episode. Oh my gosh. So, and actually it's funny, you kind of started getting into this about the same time that I did back in kind of that 2015, 16. Yeah. And like, there was like nobody else really around. Yeah. And so it's been so cool to watch the field grow these last several years. Mm-hmm. And even see how much has changed. So when I first started, I think Patrick McKeown only had Close Your Mouth out. Mm-hmm. And Buteyko breathing was kind of the only breathing we were talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
And now there's so much more out there when it really comes to breath work. So what's been your, because I know that's something you specialize in. What's been kind of your journey and what kind of breath work are you working with your patients with now?
Yeah. So, I mean, have you guys heard it's like breath work is the new yoga? It's very trendy.
I
can
say that. Yeah.
And there's like breath work certification, you know, 3-day course in Bali, all these things. My approach to breath, I wouldn't even call it breath work, actually. I think definitions, words are very important. And breath work to me is like a CrossFit workout or something strenuous. So I think this gets all the press and the attention. It's like kind of what people understand. But I think a more important place to place our focus with breath is on optimal breathing. I call it 23/7, 365. So assuming you do some sort of breath work exercise, I mean, that's going to be 20 minutes to maybe an hour a day. But I want to ask the question is, how are people breathing when they're not doing an exercise like a breath work? And is it optimal? Are they getting good carbon dioxide exchange, oxygen exchange? Are they getting optimal blood flow to the brain? So I have a paradigm where I measure for a new patient. I'd use a capnograph and I measure the respiration rate and their carbon dioxide levels through a nasal cannula, through an instrument, and have ability to give them biofeedback so they can repattern their breath using biofeedback.
So cool. That like gives you like it's interesting. And actually when we had Dr. Brett come on the episode too, like talking so much about the clinical piece, but also bringing in the numbers and kind of marrying them together, the science plus the human experience. And I think that's so cool that you can measure those things.
Yeah. It's interesting too. I've started to drift away even from the numbers to some extent, because like if someone is, well, maybe give another analogy, you know, why is it that someone eats all meat in their diet and someone eats all veggies and they both think they're doing better? It's because they both quit eating packaged foods and processed foods. So a lot of times I think breathing is similar. Like the standard American breathing is so dysfunctional that almost any conscious change in breathing is an improvement. So if someone does a little bit of breath work, they develop a certain level of breath competence or breath fitness or capacity that's helpful. But, you know, it's like, I wouldn't recommend doing CrossFit exercise every day, all day, continuously. It's a eustress, you know, you stress your body out and then you need to recover. So I think that's one of the missing pieces is how do you help people know how they're breathing and what their CO2 level is, their respiration rate, and then how could you help them through instrumentation get more optimally breathing? So I tend to think that like if someone took a Buteyko course or got an app on their phone that helped them breathe slower, they're probably most likely just breathing deeper and keeping their CO2 at the same level, you know, even if they're doing a control pause and those things. So I think the instrumentation can be really helpful for a time, but in the paradigm I use, it's like, it's a month of an instrument, it's a rental, and then you don't need the instrument anymore. It's like you learn to ride the bike, then you don't need the instrument anymore. So I think what I'm moving towards now is if someone's really dysfunctional, they need the biofeedback, but then at some point counting the breaths and having all the feedback gets in the way of flow. So then people need to learn how to be in flow and have a balanced nervous system and be able to, you know, speed up or slow down the breath to extend the exhale or shorten the exhale, or, you know, it's an instrument. It's really, I see breath as levers on your autonomic nervous system. So if you know how to use those wisely, I mean, you have God mode in your physiology and your brain to breathe in a way that suits every moment of every day based on that day's demands, based on if you've had enough sleep, or, you know, it just really gives access to a level of being that is unparalleled, I think, with almost any other thing I can think of.
I love that phrase you just said, breath is the lever of the autonomic nervous system. Like,
yeah, I don't think I came up with that, but it's a good one.
I'll give you credit. That's really cool, because I think what you were saying about the counting and stuff, I feel like everything is in baby steps, like whatever you can handle. Some people, they have such a short attention spans that maybe that's all they're ready for is like the in for four, hold for four, out for four, hold for four. Maybe some people, they're able to quiet the monkey mind enough that they can go to that next level. And then the real magic happens when you can get into that flow state.
Yeah.
So for our people who don't know what flow is or what a flow state is, can you just explain a little bit about that concept?
I mean, when I think of flow, I think of like Michael Jordan scoring 65 points or something in a game. Like he can't miss. He's like, no one can touch him. He's jumping higher, running faster, even for Michael Jordan. So, and that is a state where, you know, all your nervous system is just perfectly suited for the task that you've given it. There's a lot of practice involved too. So I think on a more just daily level, it's just being able to operate without being so conscious and thinking through thoughts to force it to happen. You're just like, your day is flowing. It feels like a perfect day. Like you're having good conversations and you're effective in what you're doing. But I think the breath, the nervous system and the breath release can support that, where you can make life a lot easier or life's a lot harder. You know, if you're hyperventilating and you have low CO2 and you're CO2 intolerant and you have low blood flow to the brain and cold hands and feet, then that's a chronic issue that a lot of people face. I mean, the way I look at dentistry and medicine is the average American is pretty sick. So I would call average, it means to me, average unhealthy. So you have very few people that have optimal health. And so I test every adult new patient with a capnograph, and I would say the vast majority are, well, let me ask you this. What have you heard is the optimal breathing rate? So we're talking respirations per minute or respiration rate. What have you heard is sort of textbook or sort of average?
Isn't it like 12 to 15?
Yeah, that's a good one. I've heard 14 to 16, and 12 to 20 is a wider range that I've heard. But that's great. But also, if you think about that, I believe that is average, unhealthy, normal. You know, it's just someone walks into the ER and they test them, and that's what they're going to get. So I want to ask, what is dysfunctional and what is optimal? So I do test a lot of people and they're actually closer to 20. So just breathing at 20 breaths a minute, I believe that is just the respiration rate being that high is going to drive someone in their nervous system more towards a sympathetic dominance. So they're going to tend to be more in fight or flight just by the nature of their fast breathing. So then when I test the CO2 level, CO2 should be around 40 millimeters of mercury as an end-tidal CO2. That correlates to a arterial CO2. So you measure it through a nasal cannula, a little device with a pump connected to a computer. What's wild too is that, you know, I'm looking at the regional medical center across the street. I used to work in the IT department over there. There's capnographs in the ER in every operating room. And dentists too, we're doing conscious sedation. They're using a capnograph, but they're using it in a different way than I use it. They're looking to make sure that the person doesn't stop ventilating, where oxygen saturation would take a long time to fall, but a CO2 rise would happen almost immediately. So they get an alarm bell on the capnograph saying, hey, CO2 just went to 60. Maybe the ventilator is not working or there's an airway obstruction. So it's standard of care in operating rooms. But what they're not doing, I don't think that I'm doing, is looking at, for the upright and awake ambulatory patient, what is their breathing chemistry and is it suboptimal? And so most people are not anywhere near 40 millimeters mercury CO2. They're around 30, 35, which means I'll have less blood flow to the brain chronically, maybe cold hands or feet. And then, you know, your breathing is really sensitive way to control your blood chemistry, your blood pH. And blood has to be between like 7.35 and 7.45. So not much of a range around perfectly neutral, or else like your enzymatic reactions, your biochemical reactions, proteins in the body just cease to function and you would die really quickly. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one reason why people hyperventilate is carbon dioxide is an acid. It's a proton. And so if you blow it off, then you're neutralizing acidity in your body. But so that can happen like in seconds or instant. But then the thing is, if you remember your chemistry, you have to have a buffering solution in your titration mechanism. And so basically the body, if someone's chronically hyperventilating, they're going to have to borrow minerals, and that's going to come from bones and teeth. So Someone that's chronically hyperventilating and has low CO2, they might have low bone density or even tooth issues, minerals coming out of the teeth to support that chronic hyperventilation.
That's so interesting, because we think of people who mouth breathe as being more prone to decay, mm-hmm. almost in like a, it's drying the plaque, dry, yes. it's dehydrating, mm-hmm. it's like less self-cleansing, but yes, I never thought true. About it from like the base the buffering. Level. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I think it's all inclusive, but yeah, I believe this chemistry aspect maybe is less understood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, you can also use the breath for other purposes too, right? So I know that you're really into breath work. What are you into right now?
Well, I mean, I always have this idea. I think it's really profound, but I'm just kind of feeling my way, is that it has to do with, like, have you guys ever heard of heart math? I'm pretty familiar with that. It's like the little sensor you clip on your ear, and then you have the app that kind of, you kind of breathe with it, but it's a little mandala that expands and contracts. Is that ringing a bell?
No, oh, no. Tell us about it.
Okay, so yeah. HeartMath, it's pretty well established and they have a lot of research. It falls within a field they called basically heart rate or HRV biofeedback. So okay, it's really popular.
That. Okay. Yeah.
So it's basically an instrument that usually works through a pulse ox type of device on the finger, on the earlobe or something, or an EKG type of sticker on your body. But it's basically finding a heart rate variability, which is a beat to beat interval, the R to R interval on an echocardiogram, a QRS wave. So, you know, you want to have a variable heart rate. If you have a metronomic heart rate, that means you're more in sympathetic dominance. So it's unhealthy to have low heart rate variability. So you want high heart rate variability. So like an Oura Ring or a Fitbit or Apple Watch, you know, it can measure your heart rate variability. And the score is fairly individualized or personal, but in general, you want to have more variability, which means you would be able to either chill or run, and you could easily, you know, go from rest to running and recover. So if someone's like on a pacemaker, then that means they aren't as able to speed up or slow down. So that's where, you know, a lot of people see HRV as a master vital sign of overall health. I've used an app where, like, the iPhone camera, can you take a daily reading? It's called like HRV biofeedback, but it's used by athletes. So they'll use it to see, have they overtrained? And if their HRV gets too low, they'll like maybe back off the training. And they always want to keep a certain level of HRV daily so they know how to go with their training. But back to HRV biofeedback is there's a lot of apps and things out there where they measure the HRV and then they have you breathe in a certain rate. And that'll bring an optimal balance to the nervous system, specifically put you in a more parasympathetic state of the vagus nerve. And so you're more in rest and digest than fight or flight. When capnography is, I think, unique and it's not used as much, but it samples the air so you can actually get a reading on the CO2. But anyway, HeartMath is a tool where it's kind of more non-clinical. So they just have you follow this thing on the screen that's expanding and contracting. It's like a colorful mandala. But what they're going for, if you look at their research, is what's called a resonance breathing or coherence. So there's a specific rate of breath which brings the heart and the brain and the body into balance and actually literally synchronizes things like blood pressure. And you probably can remember what this is. It's in James Nestor's book and other places, but you know, we talked about normal breathing. So what's optimal breathing rates? Do you remember? So 12 to 20 is the big range that's maybe not healthy, and 12 and 20 is not healthy. So what is there an optimal range you know of?
I've heard people that do Buteyko can do like 5 to 6 breaths a
minute. Yeah, exactly.
6 to 9 was kind of what I was.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say 6 to 10 is a nice range. But one of the really cool things that James Nestor talked about in the book, Breath, is, you know, he said it's the new science of a lost art. He found that like certain yoga mantras and rosary beads and certain liturgies, these ancient wisdom traditions, they actually calibrated people's breath to 6 breaths a minute.
6, right? That's yeah. Cool. I think you talked, I think you talked about it on our episode. I'm like, 6, why does 6 sound so familiar?
Yeah.
Because
that's it.
Because I remember sitting there, and I'm doing it now too. When I start thinking about how many times I'm breathing, I swear I start doing it more. I know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And so
I'm like, slow down.
There's some studies where they looked at heart rate variability. Where did that get optimized? And James Nestor also cites it's 5.5. But you know, we can round up. We can round up to 6. So, but the interesting thing for me with 6 is, you know, I see patterns between what someone might call harmony of the spheres. So there's a Schumann resonance of the earth. That's a certain frequency. There's all this frequency and vibration. If you look at the stars and the planets and the atoms, everything's spinning. Everything has frequency and vibration. So what's really cool is 6 breaths a minute just so happens to be 0.1 hertz. And to me, that sounds like a really powerful, like master number where, you know, it's a multiple of 1 and it's 0.1 hertz. And you would call that epsilon. So when you do like brainwave entrainment, and this is getting into EEG, the brain, but there it would be called an epsilon wave. It's 6 per minute. And so I think that's where some of the magic happens with heart, brain, body, nervous system coming into coherence at a specific frequency that's kind of on a master number.
We want to introduce this spot for Tot's course, a parent's guide for toddlers ages 2 to 5 for Mini Mayo. We have Megan and Kimmy going over nasal hygiene, myofunctional exercises, breathing exercises, tongue tie healing protocols, and then we have Jenny June going over sleep hygiene and Kelsey Baker going over feeding therapy and body work. The course is $297 and the link will be in the description.
Yeah, that's so cool. It's interesting because, you know, we're always talking about how everything's connected, and, you know, sometimes science wants to like almost like separate it. But then the other part of science is always trying to prove it, right? And finding that middle ground. And sometimes it's really hard not to just be like, it can't, like, I mean, it's just, there it is. Everything's connected. And I think some of it is in like the Western side of medicine. I think a lot of it's because we study everything separately, that we keep everything separate. Mm-hmm. And when we start to really look at things as a whole, then we're able to be a little more open to what that really truly means. So you guys all know, my dad had a traumatic brain injury back in 2017. He had a brain bleed. I'll catch you up, Dr. Sam. It's a really long story. So this is a really quick version. He ended up in a coma, cerebral hemorrhaging. There was all sorts of stuff. And then he ended up with like a frontal lobe stroke. And so I'm always looking for things because he's at, you know, and he's been in kind of a downturn lately, which has been really hard. and trying to figure out, okay, what are ways that we can like get his brain back on track and help his frontal lobe recover more. And so all this stuff always like, I'm like, man, what can we try for my dad? Right. Yeah. So I love when I'm hearing like the breath and the brain and how these things can really be connected.
Should we talk a little more about, I think the blood flow to the brain is super important to understand.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, I think I can explain that. So kind of go back to chemistry a little bit. I mean, organic chemistry is a tough course, but it helps.
Glazed over my eyes.
No, I think I'll explain it with my hands. I can do little analogies. So, all right, let's think about a red blood cell. And, you know, it's like this cool, like biconcave shape. It's like a little puck, you know. Mm-hmm. Now, on the red blood cell carry hemoglobin, that's a protein. And proteins are really complicated three-dimensional shapes. They're like little machines almost in the body. So on a hemoglobin, you've got four iron molecules, and those are the binding sites for oxygen. So let's say a red blood cell comes through the lung, and it's about to receive oxygen through the alveoli, and it wants to deliver the oxygen to the brain cell that's somewhere up here. Well, one thing that's really elegant is that in the absence of carbon dioxide, the hemoglobin will actually grip tightly to the oxygen molecules that are bound to the irons, and it will keep it stuck until it goes to the brain where it needs to be released. So, yeah, I mean, you wouldn't want the oxygen to release in the lung. That would be silly because you just got it on board so you can send it. Yeah. So what allows the oxygen to be released, what allows the hemoglobin to relax and actually open up those binding sites to release to the cell is a certain level of carbon dioxide. Because the tissue cell, like a brain cell, is doing work. It's having cellular respiration within the cell. And it's generating, let's say just for simple sake, this is pretty simple math, is a hemoglobin has four irons, so it's going to pick up four oxygen molecules, and the tissue cell is going to generate four carbon dioxide molecules, and you want to exchange four for four, you know, a one-to-one ratio. So, but if you're hyperventilating and you're breathing too fast and too deep, you might be like, say, losing too fast one of the carbon dioxide molecules at the tissue cell level, and then you could only exchange three oxygens into the cell. And so then what would happen is the carbon dioxide is also a vasodilator, opens up the blood vessels. So if the CO2 is low in the brain, there's a cool image I just saw posted the other day. It goes around the internet all the time, where with less CO2, you have less blood flow to the brain. Now, I believe the body, there's always a reason. That would be to protect from cell death. Because if your brain cell was online doing work with good blood flow and it wasn't getting adequate oxygen, it could have hypoxia and die. You don't want your brain cells to die. So rather than your brain cells dying, you're going to have less blood flow to the brain and less cognitive function. So, you know, people I test, they're like, have a 25% reduction in brain blood flow because they're chronically hyperventilating. And then what you get is a chemoreceptor in your brainstem, which makes you intolerant to higher levels of carbon dioxide. So then you kind of have to hyperventilate and keep the CO2 low. And then you're more prone to panic attacks and PTSD and anxiety. So that's where the biofeedback comes in again, too, is that you can't just give someone an app or coach them to change on a dime. It takes like 4 to 6 weeks of gradually working them their rate down and their CO2 up so they can come into balance.
That's fascinating.
So cold hands and feet is a big one. You know, cold hands and feet, that is in a lot of cases, hyperventilation syndrome. So you can warm up your fingers and toes if you, and here we'll get into this. One of the biggest misconceptions about breathing, especially because of breath work, is it needs to be big, needs to be huge, and then deep means a lot of air. Actually, there's something called samurai breathing, and the tradition goes that the samurai would be dismissed from being a samurai if they could not hold a feather under their nose without moving any little tiny piece of the feather. So you want your breathing to be so gentle that you're not even, you know, wiggling a nose hair. You know, so breathing should be extremely gentle, extremely soft. And the deep means your diaphragm is active and it's just moving the air like really gentle, like a really gentle fan or really gentle bellows.
Yeah, I think that's part of my problem, right? When I start really thinking about like when I'm counting my, and I don't necessarily do a lot of the up because I know I'm supposed to like diaphragm it, but like I definitely, when I'm really trying to like slow my breath down, it becomes more. Right. Like, and that's where it's more when I'm thinking about it, when I'm keying into it and then I'm like, relax.
Yeah. Well, I'm wanting to go on a rabbit trail about trauma. Do you want to talk about trauma and the diaphragm and the breathing?
Yes.
Heck yeah.
Oh, always. We love talking about trauma over here.
A lot of trauma is stored at the diaphragm.
Believe it.
Esoterically, it represents the wall between your lower self and your higher self. And so people store a lot of tension, a lot of trauma. And this is going back to, we talked about the Gillespie approach. You know, fascial web trauma is real, and it can happen from in utero, or, you know, babies are compressed in utero, or they have birth trauma, and then on and on it goes. So people have this tight fascial web, but the diaphragm is particularly prone to have tightness. So a lot of people are just super rigid and constricted right at the rib cage, right where the diaphragm sits. So they might need some good body work as well to kind of release that, but then they have to good breath mechanics and good breath chemistry. But the more interesting thing even than that, that I was thinking about, is there's always a behavioral payoff for breathing in a certain way. And so a lot of this comes into behavioral conditioning and psychology. But one thing that's super fascinating is, well, let me ask you a question. What would be the payoff for someone to hyperventilate and keep low blood flow to their brain? Can you think of why that would be effective in some way, even if it's a kind of a vicious cycle kind of way?
No, but I feel like you have a really good point to make afterwards.
Okay. I do. Okay. So let's imagine
someone has survival mode, like they're like drowning. Yes.
No. Okay. It's different than that. Let's say someone has a traumatic event when they're, I don't know, 13. And then somehow subtly they learn that if they hyperventilate, they keep the blood flow low to the brain and they keep that trauma suppressed and repressed. And if they were to breathe more optimally and increase the blood flow to the brain and have those brain cells come more online, they might actually experience the uprising of the trauma. So they hyperventilate to keep the trauma at bay, but they're also not releasing the trauma. They're just suppressing the trauma, but the breath, the hyperventilation is keeping the trauma suppressed. But then it's also making them more prone to panic and PTSD. So there's always biofeedback loops, but it makes sense if you think about it. If you want to avoid trauma from surfacing and you haven't gone through like EMDR to release it clinically, then hyperventilation is pretty effective to kind of keep traumatic things in the background because your blood flow to the brain is less and your brain's sort of optimizing for brain cells that need to fire and wire together to keep your daily functioning going, even if it's at sort of a less conscious level.
I was thinking about like how many like people who serve in the Army, the Navy, the military, right? And like that PTSD and a lot of like, and then also traumatic brain injuries, right? Like, I mean, obviously being anywhere with war is going to be very, very traumatic. Yeah. So I can see that being a big connection.
Yeah. And when like thinking of your dad too, like I can only imagine that having better blood flow to an area brings nutrients, brings oxygen, brings more pH balance. That should be healing to the area. So, you know, if there's anything that's limiting blood flow or oxygenation or pH balance, that's going to exacerbate any kind of injury that's already present. So it really is like a medicine like that. You know, I believe that, you know, the power that made the body heals the body, that kind of idea. So we have the mechanisms within us to be self-healing and regenerative, but we have a lot of modern things stacked against us that keep us in some vicious loops where then it doesn't happen. And then even some of the modern interventions sort of like suppress things and it creates like a delayed healing and we're not actually healing things. We're just kind of managing disease.
Yeah. So my dad had an AVM, which is an arterial venous malformation. So in his, basically like, you know, arteries and veins are supposed to be connected via capillaries. So when he was born, when people are born and they have an AVM, what happens is that webbing, like it misses those capillaries and it creates this thing. And that's just like, it looks like this huge spider monster web. And usually they burst between the ages of 5 and 40. And like there's, once I learned what it was and he went through it, it's like on every medical drama show. So if you ever get into those, like you'll hear anybody who's had a brain injury in a traumatic car accident on any medical show, they say AVM. And so he actually had two aneurysms that didn't burst. They caught it before then because his actually burst at 50, started bleeding at 54. And so that's part of why is because that whole system was missing those pieces.
Well, I don't necessarily want to speculate or change any diagnosis, but I do like to kind of think what if, and what if let's assume there's not optimal breathing probably. So let's just say like, let's just be generous and say like 80% of patients like I test have highly dysfunctional breathing. Mm-hmm. But again, like I think the body has mechanisms to compensate and but the compensations have consequences. So what if an AVM is blood vessels that are just forming to take the least worst path?
Yep.
And it's actually part of a protective cycle that becomes then a liability, you know, but if we could have optimal breathing and we have good perfusion and blood flow to the entire brain through the normal veins and arteries and capillaries, then maybe the AVM doesn't ever form. I mean, I'm by no means an expert. I'm just thinking about, are there modern stressors that maybe kind of are causing these modern conditions that wouldn't have even existed had there been, now we're going way back, like if people were chewing and breathing right, you know, the whole Western mm-hmm. price type of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. Who knows? So, yeah, the AVM thing's really, really interesting. But my dad, yeah, my dad had premolars extracted. Mm-hmm. He had sleep apnea, mm-hmm. right? Like every marker, like yeah. my dad was my guinea pig, my very first patient. He did great. Yeah. He did great in therapy, but you know.
Yeah. I think, you know, modern Western medicine can't handle that many variables in a study. Mm-hmm. They can do a drug and a sugar pill, and you get any more exotic than that, and it's just really not, you know, feasible to do a study that's evidence-based.
Yeah.
All right. So speaking of breathing, what do you think about breathing and meditation, breathing for like connecting to your spirit, connecting to your, obviously your nervous system, but when you connect to your nervous system, you're also connecting to your spirit.
Yeah, exactly.
What do you think about that?
Well, do you know what breath means in almost every language?
No.
Spirit.
Oh.
Like Latin, it's like spiritu, you know, like the priest says spiritu sanctu, stuff like that. Yeah, in almost every language, I believe breath and spirit are synonymous. So, you know, if you do want to go to that level, it's like very much so breath is a life force. You know, God breathes life into man. You know, whatever you believe there, I think it's so much more than meets the eye in terms of just gases that we're exchanging. There's really much a, well, I heard a cool thing that every breath is a pair. Like we breathe, we inhale and exhale. Like that's how I define a breath, but except for two, but they're also a pair, is the first breath we inhale and the last breath we exhale.
Whoa.
Yeah, that's deep.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
I love it.
Goosebumps.
Yeah. But to go flesh that out a little more, I do a lot of what I call pauses. And I'll take one conscious breath. I think there's so much power and calm in just one conscious breath. So we're just talking about like an inhale and you roughly maybe do, you know, 5 seconds in and 5 seconds out. So, I mean, we could do one of those right now. You just go like just doing that occasionally throughout your day, that would be so much better than what most people do. It creates space for thoughts. It regulates the nervous system. So then you could do six of those. You know, just do six, because that six breaths a minute, practice doing six breaths in 1 minute, just like set a timer on your phone, and there's apps that do this, you know, take a pause for one breath or 1 minute. And I have friends that I harp on about this, but I'm like, they're stressed out, burned out on a fast paced job. And I'm like, hey dude, can you just do like one breath, like once every hour, or, you know, between patients, like we're talking dentists doing hygiene checks and stuff, or, you know, take 1 minute or 3 minutes. I think there's so much power. This is sort of like the tiny habits concept. I don't know if you guys heard about that from BJ Fogg. His cardinal example is, after I brush my teeth, I will floss one tooth. And his methodology is, the one tooth thing is super important, because if you tell people to floss the whole mouth, they won't do it. But if they floss the one tooth, you develop the automaticity, which means doing it automatically over several weeks, where the habit becomes ingrained. And then people will naturally floss the other teeth. So I think if we could coach people to take one breath, or take six breaths in 1 minute, or maybe three is max, but just keep it simple. One breath. I mean, I just did that. It felt pretty good to me. So taking one breath once an hour, like I think that would have so much benefit spiritually, physically, psychologically, mentally, all the things.
Yeah, I think it's true. I think when we like, we want to bring on this new habit, right? We want to hit the gym and get in shape. We want to change our diets and eat super healthy. We want to read whatever every day, right? And we think we have to do these things for like an hour. Otherwise it's not effective. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like if I don't meal prep every single meal and it's healthy, why would I do it at all? If I don't go to the gym all 5 out of the 7 days a week, why would I even go once? Right. And I love this idea of, you don't have to spend an hour a day working on your breath. Like find the time during your day, one breath an hour. We all could take one breath an hour.
Well, I think you want to do like six breaths for 1 minute. That's kind of what
Let's do it.
Yeah. Like, I think, I don't know if this will work. I have like an app on my phone, and we can talk about the app later, but I might just hold it up because it has like a little pacer. So let me see if I hold this up, if it will show up good. Hang on.
We have a minute right now.
Yeah. So this thing's going to expand. So that's when you're going to breathe in, and then You just breathe out as it goes in. So this is already set to 5 seconds in, 6 seconds out. So maybe just we'll catch up with it here. Maybe let the next exhale go. So it's going to be an inhale when it gets bigger, like filling the lungs. So we can just start now. We can go. So you're going to breathe in gently. And then out. Really gentle, really slow. I'd do in through the nose, out through the nose, or even in through the nose, out through the mouth. Just very gentle. Yeah, that's it. So
felt so good. Yeah,
I mean, I think we overcomplicate things. So, I mean, I'm harping on capnograph, but really, I mean, I still harp on it. That's the thing. It just depends on the setting. I don't want to put an obstacle, though. I mean, I think that's part of the problem. They're so expensive. They got a pump and all the gadgets in there, you know, $5,000. So I know it's not for everyone. I do think some of the HRV biofeedback devices are fine too, but you know, in a clinical setting where I have access to it, I do like to test the CO2 levels and then provide an option to rent a biofeedback device. But you know, that's actually in some cases clinically, you know, FDA approved for panic and PTSD. And so it just depends on the use case for it. But yeah, I wouldn't want to stand in the way of just some of these simple breath practices because you know, we had to have the perfection of a capnograph, but it's like, mm-hmm. I want to have my cake and eat it too.
Right. Yeah. It's all right. We all do. But what is that app? That way if people want to just start there.
Yeah. It's called Cardia, which I think speaks to that heart coherence thing. Maybe we can put it in the show notes so I can send it. It's kind of, I think it's even a free one. Maybe it's $1, something like that, but yeah, it's pretty kind of more advanced. It does have a cool mode called target breathing, which is cool where, you know, you can set it to be like maybe like one thing I recommend for people if they're doing 4 weeks of therapy is they go from 13 to 11 to 9 to 6. You know, each week they're notching down their rate. So there's an app, part of this app is you could set it at 10 and you could go down to 6 over a 10 minute period or something. It's totally flexible. Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to think how I can, we can do it later. I'll find the app store link and I think it's on Android and iPhone, but. Yeah, it's a simple app. I don't actually use it that much. And like I said, I think some things are a crutch and they're great until you don't need them and then you can do things more intuitively. One thing I do like about this app is it has a silent mode and it uses like the haptic feedback that kind of bumps you. So you can have it on silent. It'll kind of do a little vibration to know when the exhale and the inhale is turning. Hmm. Yeah. And so you can lay it on your in a dark room it's designed so that blue ball, it'll project onto the ceiling in a dark room. And so you can watch it like expand and contract on your ceiling in a dark, like a dark bedroom. Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And it's a good place to start. Or if you're just feeling like overwhelmed and you're like, I can't even wrap my brain. Like you can step away and use something like that just to.
Yeah. And I think that's where the intuition would come in. If, you know, someone might not want to drop to 6 or they might feel like they have to take a breath and they have that air hunger. Mm-hmm. So, you know, picking a rate, and going really gentle and just feeling into the body. I think that's something I just saw recently where someone's like, maybe we don't always need all this hardware and gurus. We just need to be with our own bodies and breathe. And there's a lot of power in that. Mm. And I think tuning into the nervous system, but I think just a lot of people are disconnected from that. So
yeah,
we just need to come back to our own bodies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know. Get through the noise, come back to your bodies. I love it. Okay. So are you pretty active on social media?
I'm kind of more lately Dr. Sam Zink on Instagram. That's okay. I mean, my place I've been posting, but it's more personal and stuff I'm into. I have Zink Dental on Instagram and that's more for the practice, but I haven't been too active there lately. I'm kind of an old fuddy-duddy. You know my age now. I'm old enough where I'm like technically a Gen X, but anyway, it's on the dividing line, but I kind of have this resistance to social media. Like I don't want to do the whole like dancing reels, you know, and like point at things.
We don't
like,
either.
I'm not doing that.
No, you don't have to follow the trends, but if people want to find you, if they want to get in touch with your office, we want to give them a place to do that.
Yeah, zinkdental.com is the website, or Dr. Sam Zink, they go to the same place. And then, yeah, same thing, Instagram, Dr. Sam Zink, Zink Dental. And then I think there's Facebook, but I'm not a Facebook guy, but they're letters, I think, technically linked.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Awesome. And of course, if you guys want to find us, you can find Kimmy at Mouth Muscle Memory. You can find me at NWMFT. You can find us both at the Munch Bunch Podcast. And of course, if you guys want to come see us in person, we are going to be talking and doing a lot of work around breath at our burnout and business retreat in the Dominican Republic, November 9th through 12th. Cool. So yes, Dr. Sam, come on with us and lead us in some breath work. Bring the fam.
Yeah, we haven't talked about that yet. You have to fill me in on the details.
Yes. So all the details for that are on our websites, on our Instagrams. And also we did, there's been a change in our checkout system to where we offer financing as well for your retreat ticket. So if you guys are interested in that, reach out to us, set up a free discovery call with us. And a free business strategy call. We're happy to chat with you guys about that as well. So thank you again, yeah, Dr. Sam. So fun. Great Munchy Monday. and we'll see you guys soon.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
We have a special offer for our Munch Bunch listeners. To book a virtual consult with Megan, she's offering a discount of $25 off. Just email her, Megan, at nwmyofunctionaltherapy.com or through her website, www.orofacial-myology.com. To book a virtual consult with Kimmy for the $25 off, email her, mouthmusclememory@outlook.com or through the website, www.mouthmusclememory.com.